You are listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Giant naked guy.
Ancient tools and burials, plants and seeds, Neanderthals. All these things we make no apology for the study of archaeology. But we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Archaeology Fantasies podcast. We talk about the hot topics in today's fringe archaeology and alternative history from a critical point of view. I'm your host, Sarah, with my co-host, Kenneth Bader. This is episode 3, where we talk about the media's portrayal of fringe archaeology, Ken's brush with movie fame, and giants. Get ready to think critically.
Digging in a trench, monuments, going to the pub when the day is spent. Funny beady blokes, you will see, are a staple of archaeology.
Well, welcome everybody back to the podcast. I'm your host, Sarah, and my co-host, Ken Fader.
Good to be here, Sarah.
Good to see you. How's the weather up there? Is it still crappy like it was last time?
Well, the weird thing today, it's actually getting better. This nor'easter that we had that started off with ice and then became rain. It rained, and it was just the rivers are incredibly high. Last night and today, it was snowing much of the day, but it was warm enough that the snow all melted off. We didn't get any accumulation. It wasn't a real big hassle with roads, but I live in a forested area up in here in northwestern Connecticut, and it's just gorgeous. All the conifers are just coated with snow. It looks like a Currier and Ives postcard. It's really pretty.
Now you're just bragging.
Hey, listen, what can I tell you? You know, it's beautiful. And the roads are okay. So the students cannot say, well, we can't make the final because the roads are bad. And now the roads are fine. My favorite is when they tell me they couldn't come to class and I ask, well, how far was your drive? And they said, oh no, I live on campus, but they didn't want to walk across campus. I said, you know, you can walk across campus in the snow. It's really okay.
Yeah, it's okay. You can survive that. Okay. Well, today we are going to talk about, basically how the media treats, the media treats pseudo-archaeology. I thought we'd touch on History Channel because they have a variety of shows. But you have had some personal experiences with this kind of thing.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about the movie you were in and how you handled that situation?
Well, the cool thing there, Sarah, is that I complained so much that it was the movie that I was not in, although a bunch of my colleagues were. I was interviewed. But before I even get into that, I want to preface this with something, because we are going to be talking about a lot of it's going to be talking about cable TV, because they seem to be some of the worst of the offenders when it comes to, you know, pseudo archaeology. But I remember years and years ago reading a little essay that was written about television when it first got started. I mean, we're talking about television in the 1940s.
Right. And
people were asking, well, what do you think the major focus of television is? What's at the heart of television? What's its purpose? What is the fundamental reason television exists? And people were talking about, well, there's entertainment, there's sports, there's news, there's the weather, there's information, there's science programs. But bottom line, this cynic responded, the fundamental reason for the existence of television is to sell laundry detergent. And that was
soap operas.
It was a metaphor for, you know what, the bottom line here is that the business model that we have here in America for commercial television and, you know, welcome to capitalism is they want eyes in front of the TV screen. They want big numbers so they can charge other people a lot of money to advertise their products. Television is the engine that drives television is advertising, is selling stuff. And that the bottom line here, and we can't be naive about it, is that as good as some TV is, or wonderful actors and terrific directors and writers and interesting shows, but as good as it is, the bottom line is if they can't sell laundry detergent, the show doesn't get made, it doesn't last on the air. And as long as there are sets of eyes watching those screens, no matter how dumb you and I might think those shows are, no matter how fake the stuff is, ultimately, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference to the people holding the purse strings, because as long as you can show that there are big numbers and they can sell advertising time, that's what it's all about. So there are shows we'll be talking about today, I'm sure, that it would seem that any rational person watching would say, well, wait a minute, that doesn't sound legitimate. But as long as people are willing to watch it, those shows will remain on the air. And our responsibility as archaeologists is to point out to people that may be entertaining. There may be a lot of people who want to see that stuff, but here's why we think it is harmful for people to have these very gross distortions thrown at them about the past. And that leads me to the story that we opened up with. Several years ago, I was at a conference in Ohio, in fact, at the Johnson Hummerkaus Museum. It's a wonderful little museum in Ohio. And I was there with a number of people, a number of colleagues, including Brad Lepper, archaeologist in Ohio, who's at the Ohio Historical Society. Brilliant guy, wonderful archaeologist. Terry Barnhart, who is a historian, was involved in this as well, and a number of other people. While we were there, kind of blindsided, each one of us individually got a phone call from a television documentary producer. That's how they presented themselves. Right. And the way they presented themselves was really quite interesting, at least to me, when I asked them, well, what are you going to be talking about? Why do you need us? And they said, we want to do a video because we feel that Native American culture has been ignored for too long in popular media. Well, that sounds really good. And they said, in fact, our video is going to be all about the lost civilizations of America. Now, I've got to tell you, when I hear lost civilizations, that's a code word as far as I'm concerned. That usually means Atlantis or something like Atlantis, because it's the lost continent, right? Right. And we've all heard this before. Those of us who've done archaeology in the North America, we know that lost civilization tends to mean ascribing what we know to be Native American sites to some other group of people, some mysterious group who came here, and they're a lost civilization, but they built the mounds or they built the large structures in the Southwest. So it's not really Indians, it's somebody else's lost civilization. Right. So I brought that up to these people. I actually said, do you mean like Atlantis? And they said, oh, no. We're talking about something real. And I think all of us in archaeology, there's so little good archaeology on TV that when we're approached by somebody who says, hey, look, this is something that's going to be really positive. We want to help. We want to be involved. And so I was interviewed. Brad Lepper was interviewed. Terry Barnhart was, again, a historian. Deborah Bolnick, who's a biological anthropologist, was interviewed. And and Sonia Atelier, who is an anthropologist who also happens to be a Native American.
Right.
They also interviewed Alice Kehoe and a number of other people. We were sent, to the credit of the producers, we were sent a pre-publication production DVD of what the show was going to be. And we were all absolutely appalled because essentially what the DVD was.
You got this DVD after you all had been interviewed and after the show had been recorded.
Right. In other words, we had been interviewed, all right, and now they're working on the edit. This was like a first edit before it was released to the public.
Okay.
So these guys were being honest and saying, hey, listen, this is what we put together. We'd like your feedback. And we began talking amongst each other, you know, via email saying, oh, my God, did you see this?
Right.
This is absolutely bizarre because fundamentally what its underlying theme was that the mounds of Ohio had been built by interlopers from Israel 2,000 years ago, that ancient Israelis – lost tribes of Israel or something like that had arrived in North America, had come to Ohio and had started building mounds and leaving inscriptions in Paleo Hebrew behind. Now, the thing is, it was very clever edits that they performed. So it made it sound like Brad Lepper is a good friend of mine and a colleague, and he has written more extensively about some fake artifacts called the Newark Coley Stones. He's written about this more than anybody else has.
Right.
And the Newark Coley Stones were featured prominently in the video. You know, they never asked Brad, well, so what do you think about the Newark Coley Stones? They ignored that entirely. But the reason why they interviewed professional archaeologists, is what they wanted from us, and we gave it to them naively, was an agreement that, yeah, you know, there were a lot of European settlers in America in the 18th and 19th centuries who denied that the native people had been responsible for the mounds. The whole mound builder myth, this mysterious group of folks who were not Native Americans who ostensibly had built the mounds, that's on the European settlers, colonists, travelers through the American Midwest, who simply, for fundamentally what were racist reasons, denied that Native Americans had been responsible. So somehow in the video, they managed to, they believed that by archaeologists today denying that a great civilization, i.e. people from the Middle East, had built the mounds, that in fact, the standard conservative traditional archaeological interpretation that we had was the same as what people had been saying back in the 19th century. So it was this weird intellectual leap that here we are, archaeologists, who will give you the gospel about the Native American responsibility for these wonderful archaeological sites and the enormous sophistication of their civilization. But somehow that was being interpreted as us denying that Native Americans were responsible for the mounds. It was really very peculiar. And the way that they edited it, the way that they cut it, really sounded... I'll give you I ended up not being in the video, but right. The worst part of it for me was, all right, they asked me about, well, what kind of evidence would you need to prove that people from someplace outside of North America actually got here before Columbus? And I said, well, that's actually a really interesting question, because in fact, archaeologists today absolutely will confirm that. And I gave them the whole story of L'Anse aux Meadows, the Norse site in Newfoundland that dates to 500 years before Columbus. Right. And I tried in that to explain, this is the kind of evidence we would need. You look at that 500-year-old site, and you've got radiocarbon dates that date to the right period of the sagas, the written documents that the Norse, the things that they recorded about this trip west of Greenland. So we have charcoal, we have structures, house remains that look like Norse house remains. We have an iron smithy. We have bronze artifacts. We have iron artifacts. So you have this, we have a soapstone spindle whorl. You have a ring-headed bronze pin. You have all these artifacts in stratigraphic context from a date that's about 1,000, AD 1,000. And very clearly, this is Norse. This is the kind of evidence you'd expect. My point was, If ancient tribes of Israel arrived in Ohio 2,000 years ago, we would have more than simply a couple of enigmatic artifacts with Hebrew on them. We would have whole communities, villages of people. If people are building mounds, man, there have to be a lot of them. They have to be in one place for a long time. And the archaeological record would show that. They, in the original edit, with me in it, they had it. The point of my testimony was to show how, well, if the Norse could do it, if clearly we've broken that Columbus stranglehold on who discovered America, well, then why stop at the Norse? Why not Phoenicians or Celts or lost tribes of Israel?
So that we have no evidence.
Yeah, and they were using this as a case study, just, yes, it did happen one time, and then ignoring the evidence that we required in order to accept that scenario,
right.
Which was very bizarre. And again, one of the things that I said when I was being interviewed that I thought was important, but that, of course, didn't end up in the final movie, was that very often people accuse archaeologists of being not just skeptics, but cynics. We don't just we are doubters and naysayers, and we will never change our previously held conceptions. And what I told to these guys, I said, look, we're archaeologists. And so don't be surprised when archaeologists say, yeah, written documents are nice, but we want hard physical evidence. That's our stock and trade. The gold standard for any archaeologist in saying those people from over there came over here is, where's their stuff? Where's right. the stuff that's diagnostically theirs? Doesn't belong to anybody else. It's theirs. It's material made from their area in a style that reflects their culture and on and on. And mm-hmm. so the point I was making was until the early 1960s when Anstein Innstadt and Helge Innstadt actually found physical evidence in Newfoundland, you're damn right archaeologists were skeptical about taking the Norse sagas literally. That didn't mean we were wrong to be skeptical. It meant, listen, we're going to be skeptics until physical evidence is forthcoming. As soon as that physical evidence was forthcoming, archaeologists all said, that's awesome. That's great. You yeah. now have proven that the sagas are legit. Nobody jumped off of a building, you know, out of a building. Nobody killed themselves. Nobody became manically depressed. Nobody was institutionalized. We all said, wow, that's fabulous, because that's exactly yeah. what we need. You know, it the was. Same thing is true in virtually any other case where archaeologists or historians say, you know, we're kind of skeptical about that. But then when the definitive diagnostic evidence is brought forth, oh yeah, okay. Anyway, so what happened with the legend, the lost civilizations of North America, is that what Brad and all of us actually working together posted a disclaimer on the Ohio Historical Society's website saying, hey, look, everybody, we're in this show. And if you were to watch this show not terribly carefully, it would sound like we were providing confirming evidence, confirming testimony to the basic claim that, you know what, people from somewhere else came to North America in antiquity and built these mounds. And we were saying that we absolutely disagree. We don't accept that. So we wrote a disclaimer. I know that Alice Kehoe wrote a short piece that was published saying, hey, listen, you guys have completely misrepresented what we were saying. And then Brad and Terry and Deborah Bolnick and I actually wrote a 3-part article for the Skeptical Inquirer where we talked about just sort of the general issues of trying to deny that Native Americans were responsible for the mounds and putting it in historical context. Brad was the primary author of an article about Newark Holy Stones and other artifacts that supposedly have old world scripts that date to antiquity. And then Deborah wrote her piece about the DNA analysis. She's done amazing work on Native American DNA and has shown very clearly that the DNA found in the skeletal remains of Native Americans all is traceable to Northeast Asia and not Southwest Asia and not Israel or Lebanon or Jordan. And so he wrote those pieces out. My favorite part about the lost civilizations of North America is that the video was highlighted in an episode of one of the Glenn Beck's show, where Glenn Beck was showing pieces of the video and saying, why has this been hidden from us? Why have I never heard of this? Jews in Ohio 2,000 years ago.
Profiles in CRM, a weekly podcast, asks CRM professionals 8 simple questions. The first questions establish education, location, and experience. The last questions are a reflection of that experience, and the answers will surprise you. Check out the show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/profiles. On that page, you can also request to be interviewed for the show. It only takes 20 minutes, and you don't need any special equipment. Now let's get back to the show.
One of my favorite stories about that, about the Newark Holy Stones, is that recently I was in front of a committee on my campus and applying for a sabbatical, and I'm talking about some of these fake inscriptions found primarily in the 19th century. And I actually have in my hand a replica of one of the Newark Holy Stones. It looks kind of like a plumb bob, and it's got Hebrew writing. I mean, I recognize it as Hebrew writing on 4 sides of it. And I passed it around to this committee, and one of the people on the committee is an Orthodox Jew who knows Hebrew.
Right.
And he said, well, what is this exactly? And I said, well, this is supposed to be an object from 2,000 years ago left by Jews in Ohio. And he said, 2,000 years ago? I said, yes. And he looked at it and he said, but this is the wrong kind of Hebrew. This is modern Hebrew. So here's a guy who knows nothing, no prompting, nothing at all, foreknowledge about this artifact, but immediately diagnoses it as a fake because it's Hebrew that only was developed like a couple of hundred years ago. I said, yeah, well, that's exactly the kind of problem that we have.
So tell me how, because I know that, I mean, you said kind of offhandedly that you complained enough that they took you out of the video.
Right.
But when my professor explained it to me, apparently you had to like threaten legal action to get out of the video. So what exactly, what process did you end up having to go through to have them edit you out?
Ultimately, I did not, I didn't have to bring up a lawsuit or an attorney at all. The person who had the most, the greatest number of problems was Deborah Bolnick, who actually brought a copy of this to her on-campus attorney because, you know, she's not, I'm tenured full professor, so I'm bulletproof, but she's not. And she was very much concerned that anybody seeing this video would think that somehow she had kind of lost her marbles and was supporting something that clearly had no, there was no evidentiary basis for. So she's the one who I think had who actually threatened or at least brought up the possibility that she would engage in legal action. If I remember correctly, one of Deborah's major problems was, and this happens when you do videos, when you're interviewed for documentaries, they may interview you for 3 hours and 5 minutes of it ends up in the video.
Right.
And when they edited her stuff, Deborah was convinced that they had sort of reversed questions and answers. So if she said yes to an answer, and that was her legitimate answer, and said no to something else, that what showed up on the video sounded like she was saying no or saying yes to a question that she actually answered no to. And so that was kind of the biggest issue. And I guess that they dealt with that, and they claimed that it was all a misunderstanding and that they didn't come with any preconceived notions. Now, what we found out later on was that the people involved in the video were, in fact, what some Mormons have explained to me as kind of a fringe sect of Mormons. So that a lot of what you saw in that video, which is why Glenn Beck embraced it, was, in fact, a kind of literal interpretation of the Book of Mormon that most Mormons do not adhere to, but that some do. And so some of the responses that we got to our articles and to our posting, our disclaimer posting, some of the strongest support we got was from mainstream Mormons who said, yeah, these guys are crazy.
Yeah. Okay. So did they pull her interviews or did they just adjust her interviews?
They adjusted her interviews.
No, they pulled you completely.
They pulled me completely. And, you know, I never found out. I was grateful that they did and was never quite certain why they did. But I think that ultimately there just was no way they could. And this wasn't because I was smarter than anybody else. It's just that the things they asked me to comment on, they could not so misrepresent that they could use my material. Although they tried, it just wasn't working for them. That's the only interpretation that I have. That they just my stuff just didn't work according to their overall view. But they could interview Brad Lepper talking about the amazing Octagon Earthworks and use that as see. People don't know about these sites because there's this conspiracy of silence. And yet even a professional archaeologist admits that these were spectacular places. One of the funniest parts about this, Sarah, was mm-hmm. that one of the underlying themes was that the archaeological community has engaged in a conspiracy to keep it quiet, that people in the New World in antiquity had enormous urban settlements like Cahokia or spectacular mound sites like Serpent Mound or like Mound City. And so that they were in this video blowing the lid off, man. They were exposing this to light where us archaeologists, of course, had been trying to hide it. And I thought that was hilarious when you, and I did at some point a little bit of a survey, and just like in the American Midwest alone, there are like 80 mound sites open to the public many of them with museums. You get a site like Cahokia. Cahokia has a state-of-the-art museum, and the last I looked, their attendance in a given year is over 300,000 people.
Right.
We're doing a pretty lousy job of trying to keep it quiet. If we build museums and encourage people to come, and we get 300,000 visitors, how does that fit some kind of a theory of a conspiracy to keep it all quiet? It was just kind of absurd on its face. Now, yeah. One of the things that all of us will admit, all archaeologists will admit, is that, you know what? Not enough people are aware of the spectacular technological, engineering, scientific, mathematical achievements of Native Americans, of American Indians. Too many people, if you say American Indian, if you say Indian, the immediate image they have in their minds is of nomadic, primitive people living in teepees and hunting buffalo. And yeah, there were some people who lived in teepees and hunted buffalo, but that is a huge variety and diversity of cultures. North America had aboriginally as diverse an array of cultures as any other continent in the world, and more people need to know about that, and it's unfortunate that we don't, but that's on us. Archaeologists working maybe with cable TV should get out there and spread the word of this amazing and spectacular archaeological heritage that we find right here in America, and it has nothing to do with ancient aliens, and has nothing to do with Templar Knights, and has nothing to do with ancient Israelites or Phoenicians or Celts or Romans or Egyptians. It has everything to do with Native Americans working this stuff out on their own without help from, you know, a Peace Corps or whatever it is you want to call it.
Right.
That's really important. My funny story is when I was an undergraduate, I actually did a term paper about Cahokia. I'd never heard of it before. Cahokia is this amazing site in Illinois, east side of the Mississippi River, nearby St. Louis, in I think it's Collinsville, Illinois. And this site may have had a population of over 10,000 people. There are 200 mounds. Monk's Mound, which is the largest earthwork in North America, is by volume the fifth largest pyramid in the world. That includes all the pyramids in Egypt and Mesoamerica. So it's a huge communal piece of work by a large coordinated workforce. These people were agricultural. They were sedentary. They traded over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of miles of raw materials. So these guys are a sophisticated, enormously well-developed, highly developed civilization. The right. Civilization is the only word we can use for it. And
massive. So yeah, I mean,
exactly. Yeah.
The numbers I've seen is there are more people living in Cahokia than there is in modern Paris. So.
It is one at the time. It was one of the largest settlements in the world. When you look at the oldest cities, the places that are defined as urban settlements in the Middle East, these are places mentioned in the Bible. So you have Ur and Uruk and Eridu. The kind of the cutoff point for population size, where archaeologists and historical geographers and cultural geographers will say that's a city, is about 10,000 people. So when we look at the Middle East, we say, wow, that's a city. There's 10,000 people. Well, guess what? AD 1400 in what today is Collinsville, Illinois, there was a city. It was a Native American city. The first time I saw it, though, Sarah, I was at a Society for American Archaeology conference, and I was a grad student. And I thought, oh, this is so great. It was in St. Louis, so I was, you know, within spitting distance of Cahokia. And I went downstairs to the lobby to ask, you know, the guy behind the desk, how do I get to Cahokia? He had no idea what I was talking about. None.
He said,
what's that, sir? And I said, Cahokia, you know, the big Indian site. And he looked at me like I was demented. And he said, oh, sir, there haven't been any Indians around here for years.
Well, so, and that's kind of amazing, because you can see Monk's Mound from the interstate. Like, you will drive past it. You can't miss it. It's massive. And well, you know, the interstate is practically right next to it, too. So,
right. You know. Yeah, when I was there, when I actually took a bus to Cahokia, and even the bus driver, he said, oh, where those big hills are? He said, he just thought, well, they're just kind of hills. I said, no, man, those are pyramids of earth. I said, wow, yeah. I didn't know that. But it's a great place. I encourage everybody, if you know, you get a chance to see Cahokia, come away amazed because of not just the large structures all over the place, you know, the large mounds, but the artifacts that have been excavated at Cahokia and are there in their museum. Just absolutely astonishing stuff.
Okay, so that's your story with dealing with the, what was the name of the video? One more time.
It is The Lost Civilizations of North America.
Lost Civilizations of North America, and I'm pretty sure I can find a link to it because we got a link when I was in class.
Yeah, you definitely can. And they, I think they're still, I don't believe, I think what happened was they were doing this on spec. So in other words, they the producers of this, I don't think, had a contract with a cable network to show this. So they did it on spec. They farmed it out. I don't know if the controversy prevented them from actually selling it. But then, so what they ended up doing was just selling it on their own, the DVDs. And, you know, when you get somebody like Glenn Beck, who's got a huge following, and you get Glenn Beck highlighting it and saying, everybody should know about this, I imagine they sold quite a few of them. But I don't know.
Well, it's out there, and it's honestly worth a watch because it's a very interesting, not being a person who was interviewed for it, being a person who was watching it,
right.
It's a very interesting video because it's kind of insidious. It starts off very academic, very factual, or at least presenting itself very factual. And then it's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like looking at a surrealist painting, you know, you just suddenly start noticing little things that are off, and then it just all tumbles from there. And then by the time you get to the second half of the video, I mean, they are way off in left field. But the first half of that video can be kind of confusing if you don't know what you're listening to. And, we watch it in a room full of graduate archaeologists, mm-hmm. so we're all like, oh, God, really? What is this about?
Right.
And then it got to the genetics part, which none of us are aware of. And it's so over the top. It's so over everyone's head. I mean, I had to Google half the stuff they were talking about. And I was like, no, this isn't what. And even the Google had a hard time. But like, Google's not a geneticist. So, you know, you can't always rely on it.
Right.
But even that was enough to tell you that what they were trying to claim and prove was completely out there.
Yeah, I highly recommend anybody who's listening to this podcast, if you're interested in the deconstruction of the video, you can find the three articles that were written by Brad Lepper, Deb Bolnick, Terry Barnhart, and me. You can find them for, you know, download them for nothing on the website of the Skeptical Inquirer. That's Inquirer with an I. And if you look around for the Lost Civilizations, or use just type in my name, Feder, F-E-D-E-R, you'll find those. And the third of the articles, you're talking about the DNA, Deborah Bolnick, who's just brilliant, she does a really good job of breaking it down, especially for people who don't have a background in genetics. She can explain exactly why what their geneticists said just absolutely, either 20-year-old stuff that geneticists know is not true, so she does a great job of that. So by all means, go and check those out and see for yourself how we responded to the claims and allegations and the perspective of the producers of the video.
And we'll try to get everything linked in the show notes for this episode so that you don't have to hunt that hard.
There you go. There you go.
So okay,
I can send those to you, yeah.
I actually have links to your guys' articles because
okay,
it's one of the
fantastic
first things I read. Anyway, moving on. So you said you had a story that was similar, but it was happening to a colleague of yours?
Yeah. I don't know if have you watched any of this, what the Search for Legendary Giant, what's I don't even know what the name of the show is at this point, but it's on the History Channel, and it's the Jim and Bill Vieira, these brothers who apparently are traipsing around the country looking for evidence of, again, the Smithsonian and other archaeologists have conspired to keep the truth from the public, that in America's past is populated by giants who are 10, 20 feet tall, and that they're responsible for building the mounds. It's this incredibly bizarre thing. It's what they do is they basically and Jim Vieira is the guy who had one of these TEDx talks. You know, we all heard of the TED Talks. Well, that organization apparently had a policy where even if you weren't a famous person, and even if you weren't a person that had a lot of support from, you know, academic support or whatever, you could do a TED Talk, but it was called TEDx.
Right.
And Vieira did one, and I watched it. And it was just kind of, it was mind blowing. And I can't even describe what he's talking about. But one of the themes of his work is that, well, he's gone through a bunch of 19th century newspaper articles, taken them literally. And clearly he has never, I don't think he's ever seen a human skeleton. He certainly hasn't excavated a human skeleton. And based on these 19th century descriptions of large bones, he has decided that the Smithsonian knows about this. There's been this long-running conspiracy to hide the truth. And maybe at some point we can do a whole podcast about that show. But anyway, what they did up in Massachusetts is, and for anybody listening to this who says, man, Fader's not making any sense, I don't understand how these things are connected, trust me on this one. I'm not the one not making sense. It just really doesn't make any sense. But part of their hunt for giants, the Vieira brothers have found, or it's not, they haven't found it, it's historically well known, a stone chamber in Goshen, Massachusetts. And it's very well made. There are some tunnels, and it is a little bit mysterious. We don't know exactly who built it, when it was built, or why it was built. Somehow or another, this show has decided that this stone chamber has something to do with giants. The stone chamber, the tunnel that we have to go walk through to get to the stone chamber, is 2 feet tall. So these are very short giants, apparently, who had to go into the chamber. In any event, I'm actually reading Jason Colavito's blog about the show, and I see two names of guys I know. And these are real deal archaeologists, guys. These are people who do great work. Eric Johnson, who's a lecturer at UMass Amherst, and I've known Eric forever. And Steve Mrozowski, who's at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. And again, I mean, Mrozowski's brilliant. I mean, just spectacular. Does mostly historical sites archaeology. Really a good guy and smart. Somehow or another, Mrozowski and Eric Johnson were on this show talking about this particular feature, the stone feature.
Right.
And if you looked at the show, it sounded like, okay, we have two professional archaeologists who are confirming there's something extremely mysterious going on here. Now, Mrozowski has been so incensed at how his stuff was edited and shaped in the video. He's actually, and I'll send you this link, Sarah, he's actually commented on his blog. He's at UMass Boston, and I guess it's the Fisk Center, which does it's their archaeology center. So he's on their blog. He has a couple of detailed deconstructions of how he feels used and abused by these guys. Again, in the editing, he says, listen, they never said anything about giants. They never said anything about biblical stories. This was all about, hey, guys, we're doing a video. We've got this really interesting site. You're an archaeologist. Come and tell us what you think about it. And Steve has said, you know, he gave them a lot of details about what he thought might be going on in the site. But none of that was there. Especially Mrozowski's name was used because he's a well-known, highly respected professional archaeologist. And the fact that he knew nothing about the connection to giants is kind of telling. And he sounds pretty pissed off. And I'll send you that link. But and in fact, Brad Lepper on his blog has talked about this as, here's another example of an archaeologist thinking, well, you know, it's good to be involved in these kind of public outreach ways. And if somebody producing a video wants us to be on this and we can talk about archaeology, that's a good thing. But man, you got to be really careful, because what they're looking for is your name, and it says PhD after it. And if you say anything like, well, it's really interesting, man, they grab that, they take that out of context, they don't provide the rest of the sentence. It's really interesting, but I think it dates to probably only about 100 years ago, and it probably is some mundane thing. That's all blipped out, that's all cut out, and the only thing they've got there is you looking at the site going, wow, this is really interesting. And the Goshen Tunnel, the Goshen Chamber and Tunnel, yeah, it is really interesting. That doesn't mean it has anything to do with giants. And that's one of the things that happens is in the case of the lost civilizations. if they had come to us and said, listen, we are doing this video and our perspective is diffusion. Our perspective is that people from the Middle East came here. At least we would have been aware of what we were setting ourselves up for.
Right.
But, and I think that.
But they're deceptive on purpose because they don't want you. This is my opinion, and I think it's right because it's
right.
My opinion.
Right, of course.
But I think they purposely come to you guys deceptively because they know you won't help them if you know what they're looking for. And right. They also know that if they can get you to say just the right thing at just the right time, they can edit it and make it sound like you're supporting them. I mean, I've watched Scott Walter do this on his show a couple times, American Unearthed. He interviews, I think it's the second episode, actually. Mm-hmm. He's got the state archaeologist for, I believe it's Arizona. And, I mean, I can tell that this guy doesn't believe a damn thing Walter's trying to sell him. But right. The way that they cut it, it's very unsympathetic to him because it makes him look like at points that he is actually agreeing with Walter, even though you can tell he doesn't mean it. And so I'm like, this is just some very creative editing. And unfortunately, this guy, who is a state archaeologist, so he probably had to be there
right.
because they were on an actual archaeological site, a known site. Mm-hmm. And Walter wanted to do all this crazy crap. And he finally ends up bringing in a magnetometer mm-hmm. or a ground penetrating radar. And that's the only thing they'll let him do because you don't have to disturb the ground to use it.
Right, right.
And the whole episode, Scott's trying to convince the state archaeologist that he should just let him dig. Just let me dig. Just, you know, I can dig this in a couple days. Or there's already been people up here disturbing it. Why can't we just dig up what they've already dug? And it's just, it's one of those situations, you know. They're just
right.
waiting for the right thing so that they can twist it.
And you know, of course, you know for a fact that when we as stewards of these sites, as people who are charged with the task of protecting these sites, when we tell Scott Walter, you know what, no, you don't have the training, you do not have the skills, you don't have the credentials to dig this site, that's interpreted as, you see, they've got something to hide.
And that's exactly how he interprets it on the show. I mean, you can tell just by the way he's looking at this guy with contempt, and there's, I forget what it is, but there's some point where he's basically going, oh, let me dig. And the guy goes, no, you can't dig. We have to do the paperwork in order. He's like, if you can fund the dig and you file the paperwork and it goes through properly, you can come out here and dig. And Walter's like, oh, really? Like, he totally didn't even believe it. And it's
well,
like, no, we're just making this up, you know, because we just want to give you, just you, a really hard time. The rest of us are just out here with shovels and screens waiting for any moment to pass so that we can run out here and start screening dirt.
Hey, listen, I have a PhD in anthropology. I've been doing archaeology for more than 30 years, worked all over the state. Coming up next summer, I'm going back to a site I've excavated for 2 years and it's on state property. I have to file a bunch of paperwork. I have to tell them exactly where I'm going, what I'm going to do, what's going to happen to the artifacts. I have to submit my credentials because the state has rules and regulations. It's no different than a state or the government saying, you know, we need rules and regulations before somebody can conduct surgery, right? It's not because we're bad people or we're trying to hide something or trying to monopolize something. It's just that we do realize that you need some level of expertise to do this stuff. Federal government has various regulations for who's allowed to excavate on federal property. And it's not just credentials. You have to explain why you need to dig, what's the purpose of this dig, the disposition of the artifacts. You have to agree in advance to a timely report. So it's not, you know, when they tell Scott Walter, no, you can't dig, that's what they would tell anybody, including me, until I filled out the proper application to allow me access to that property to do excavation. That's what every one of us has to go through. That
yeah, it's a way to protect the. I mean, these are basically natural resources. It's a way to protect them. It's a way to make sure that they're done correctly. And it's also a way that if anything were to happen, there's someone to trace it back to. It's creating a chain of custody. And that's very important. And that's something that I don't think people like Walter and the other people who have these shows, I don't think they understand that we need. I mean, yeah, the paper trail is tedious and it's monotonous and it's a pain in the ass and nobody really wants to do it. But it has to be done. And it has to be done to protect the artifacts and to protect the site itself and to protect the history of the people who that site represents. Any prehistoric site that's being dug on American soil is by default a Native American site. Right. And a lot of times these people are gone. We can't go to a living person and say, hey, tell us about this site. I mean, they may have a living descendant or the tribe itself may still exist, but that doesn't mean there's anybody alive who can come down there and say, oh yeah, that's where the kiln was. And over there is where we would do whatever. There's nobody alive like that. So all we have is this footprint that's left in the dirt. And we have to be really careful with it.
Yeah, we call it a non-renewable resource.
Yeah.
Nobody's making 10,000-year-old sites anymore. Nobody's making ancient pottery kilns anymore. There are a finite number of those. And when we bulldoze or excavate the last of them, there are no more. No more left for us to learn from. So we need a really good reason for excavating a particular site. And just to satisfy your curiosity, because of some weird question you have for a cable show, that really generally is not sufficient reason to excavate a site.
But, no, and they take it as a personal attack on themselves. They're like, oh, well, you just don't want me out here because somehow my specialness is going to discover the one thing that everyone else has missed, and therefore, you know, aliens or giants or whatever.
But that actually fits perfectly with their mindset and the scenario that they're laying out. Of course, we're going to deny them access to that site because we know if they dig it up that we will be exposed, right? You know, they'll know that we've been lying to them all along. The question I think a lot of people you should ask when these things are going on or being said is that why on earth would we hide these things?
Exactly.
Why would we care? Tomorrow, if somebody could prove that they were 10-foot-tall giants roaming in Ohio 1,000 years ago, does that end my world? That would be really interesting.
Other thing that you need to ask, and I've had some very interesting responses when I ask this, is, okay, let's pretend for 5 minutes that there really were 10-foot-tall giants roaming around in Ohio. What does that change? What changes if that were true? You know, is reality suddenly going to morph around us and form into a new reality? Because it's not going to change anything that has occurred between the point that those giants apparently went extinct and today. It doesn't change anything. So it's like, why would we hide that? That would be actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
And what does it change, even if it were true?
All right, I'm here with Jordan Harbinger from The Art of Charm, and he's going to tell us what the Art of Charm podcasts are all about. Go ahead, Jordan.
Hey, sure. So thanks for the opportunity. Basically, what we do at AOC, this is the show that we wish we had 10 years ago, and I'm 34 now. So there's a lot of folks that are 20s and 30s, and we look at how we live our lives and the way that we do things. And it's always that, if I had known, if I had only known. So what I'm doing with The Art of Charm and what we're doing as a team here is we bring together the best minds in pretty much every industry to teach people how to crush it in life, with their relationships, at work, etc. So it's like having a mix of experienced mentors teaching you their expertise and packing all their research and testing and tough lessons, school of hard knocks or otherwise, into a curriculum. And we're very practical, which is great for your sort of scientific audience as well.
Yeah, absolutely. This is great for networking, for just learning some personal skills that you can use on the job, and for finding jobs and your relationships with people.
Yeah. So we talk about things like body language, the way you sit, stand, walk, and talk, networking, how to follow up with the network, how to be authentic when you're creating relationships for work. Because a lot of people think networking is like, here's my business card, give me a call when you want to buy a used car. And it's like, no, it's about giving, it's about relationships. But since people don't have a game plan, they kind of ignore it. And especially in your field, they're probably thinking, oh, I really hope my work stands up for itself someday and I get that promotion. And it's like, well, it's all about who you know. And you can either say, oh, it's all about who you know and I hate that. Or you can be like, thank goodness it's all about who you know, because I'm never going to be the top of this industry until it's too late for me to care, right?
Right. All right, so go check out the Art of Charm podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts, and you can find them also on www.theartofcharm.com.
You know, there are fringes, and then there are fringes of the fringe.
That's
so
true.
There is a fringe of the fringe of the giant thing that essentially says those giants, in fact, relate to the Nephilim of the Bible.
Oh,
so that they're not even just really tall guys. They're not just guys who, wow, would be really good in basketball. They are perhaps the hybrid. It's a hybrid species of when the angels came down to earth and mated with human women.
Right.
And then they got evil. And it's the stories are so Byzantine. It's such an incredible, you know, morass of bizarre claims. So I guess for the fringe of the fringe, yeah, it changes everything, because it proves these spirit being giants, and they mated with women, and you know, you kind of want these people to go into therapy or something. It's like we got aliens probing people up the butt, and you got angels, you know, mating with human women. There's a lot of sexual undercurrent to some of these things that I think maybe would be better left not spoken about.
That is a reoccurring theme in a lot of this stuff. So and so came here so that they could have sex with so and so. Whatever.
I've got a really cute short story. We're talking about how these video people, how these videographers, how these cable channels and producers, video producers, how they can manipulate things. I actually had several conversations with a producer, and thankfully they were very honest with me.
Producer of which show now?
It was a show about the lost continent of Atlantis, but I don't want to tell you what the show is until the end, because it kind of is this wonderful punchline to the story.
All right.
These guys they called me and they said they want an archaeologist and doing a show about Atlantis. They do what they always do. They say, oh, we've read your book. Clearly they hadn't. And I said, yes, I've done some interviews about Atlantis. I'd be happy to participate. And we're getting down to the details where they say, okay, we're going to fly you to our location and on and on and on. We'll pay your expenses. And then they said, oh, one more thing. We will need you when we interview you to say that Atlantis was real. And I said, wait, time out.
Wow, they straight up told you that.
You've read my book. You know that I'm not just skeptical. I know Atlantis didn't exist. I know it's a story that Plato made up, and I have a detailed discussion about that in one of the chapters of my book, Frauds, Myths, and Mysteries. That was a little commercial for the book. So they said, but what we need is for you to say that it is. I said, wait a minute, is this a drama and you're giving me lines, or is this, oh no, this is documentary. I said, well, no, in documentaries, you understand, you ask somebody their opinion, they share that opinion, and you either present it or you don't, but they're allowed to share their opinion. And they said, well, no, but we will need you to say it's real. I said, well, no, I'm not interested. And they said, well, can we call you back? I said, sure. They called me back a little while later. And the guy says, well, I've spoken to my executive producer, and he needs an archaeologist. Can you please tell me why you don't think Atlantis was real? So I gave him – this is after they told me they read my book. They would not have done well on the midterm, let me tell you. So I gave him the 5-minute, 10-cent version of – what Plato is trying to do, what the dialogues are all about, the fact that there is absolutely no physical evidence for this lost continent, and on and on and on. The metaphor that I used is, look, the Atlantis story is about a great, all-powerful, but evil empire trying to control and dominate its entire universe. The only thing standing in their way is a small group of people living a righteous and pure life. And while the evil empire is economically wealthy and technologically advanced and militarily powerful, and this little tiny group of people standing in the way of their dominating their world, they don't have a lot of money, and they don't have a tremendous army, and they don't have great technology, but what they have on their side is righteousness, and they're able to defeat this large enemy. And I said, essentially, the Atlantis story is Star Wars, and Atlantis is the evil empire, and it's ancient Athens in this story told by Critias, who was the main character in the dialogue, about this. The Force was with them because they were living the perfect life. And the producer said, oh, we love that. We love that. So could you tell that story but still say Atlantis was real? I said, no. I said, let me get back to you. They get back to me and they say, all right, we really want you on the show. We love that story. But what we're going to need is when we ask you questions, you don't have to say it was real, but you have to sit on the fence. You have to say you don't know. And I said, you guys aren't listening to me very, very closely.
I know it's not real.
I know it's not real. I'm not going to completely go against everything that I believe based on my analysis and my research. They said, well, can we get back to you? I said, sure. Honest to God, they called me back and said, all right, you know what, Fader? We want you. We want you to tell your story. You can say whatever you want. And here's the deal. They actually said this out loud. You can say it's not real, but we'll edit it in a way that makes it sound like you believe it's real. They actually said that to me.
Why would they? Well, I mean, at least they're being honest.
And you know what they said? They said was, listen, this way you can have deniability. When all your students and your colleagues yell at you, you can say, damn it, that's not what I said. At that point I said, listen, I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
Please stop calling me. And then I asked them an interesting question. This gets back to what the video was, which actually was on TV. I said, why, you know, good God, if you're doing a documentary, why are you not just interviewing people and sharing with the audience what their actual opinions are? And the guy said, well, we need an archaeologist to say it's real. And I said, why? And that's when he said, well, I'm not supposed to tell you this, but the video, we are an independent production company. We have been hired by ABC. I said, yeah, so? And then he said, well, do you know who owns ABC? I said, yeah, Disney does. And he then said, have you been to a movie theater recently? I said, yeah. And he said, do you have kids? I said, yeah. He says, have you noticed that there is a Disney movie, and you've seen the trailer for it, called Atlantis, the Lost Empire? And I said, oh, my God. And what they said to me was that Disney hired them to produce a documentary with scientists about Atlantis as a 90-minute long-form commercial for the Disney cartoon. Now, I said, well, that's really an interesting story. Never call me again. But when it was on, it was 90 minutes. It was on ABC. And it was an abomination. But the funny thing about it, it was actually, they had snippets of the movie, the cartoon, pure entertainment. The movie was fine. Interspersed with interviews with what people who were presented as scientists and historians, who then said, well, yeah, I mean, what's being shown in this movie could actually have happened. And it's like, oh my God. And what was really cool was that all of the art design and set design, the backgrounds, all of that stuff looked like this combination kind of Maya, Aztec and Inca architecture. Right. And that was done intentionally to make it sound like, oh my God, the stuff that you can really see in an archaeology book, that all came from Atlantis. And all of the usual suspects were on the show. All of the people, there's a couple, the Flamaths, who have written a number of books talking about Atlantis really existing, but now you can't find it because it's under the South Pole ice cap. And a bunch of other kind of really fringe thinkers, they were the ones who they got to go on the show and actually say, oh yeah, that's absolutely real. I'm not sure they certainly didn't convince me to be a participant. But that was the deal. I mean, I have to thank them. These guys were absolutely honest. They flat out told me that they would edit it so that it what I said was exactly the opposite of what turned out on the, in the video.
Well, the joke's on them because that movie bombed as far as a Disney movie is concerned.
Yeah, right.
There I don't even think they can sell it on disc anymore.
Is that right? Yeah. I mean, I thought it was, I liked the look of it. It was very silly, but to kind of, how cynical is that for a large corporation to say, listen, we've made this movie for kids, but the parents have to want to go with the kids, obviously, to see the movie. So let's make a fake documentary about Atlantis to convince people that maybe what's shown in this cartoon could, at least in a very general sense, have some basis in reality. That's
I just think it's interesting that they thought they could just approach someone and say, I need you to say this. It's like, I know I am an actual scientist. I don't do that. It's funny because I actually got approached for a television show, which just completely blew my mind. And it was kind of the same sort of a situation. Like, you know, the American Digger show and all those,
oh, right,
the pot hunting shows, they're all real big right now. Apparently, this company wanted to create a show that had to do with privy diggers and people who go and dig up outhouses and old privies and such. Okay. And they wanted me to be the resident archaeologist on the show. And I was like, no, I can't do that. That would be me saying that I'm okay with this and I'm not.
Right.
And she's like, well, why aren't you okay with it? And I'm like, well, you know, on top of it being basically looting, I mean, you're going to eventually run into human remains and there's going to be, you know, stuff that your end game here is to sell these things. And
I'm not okay
with the selling of history, even if it is the 259,000th button we've ever found. It's still a historical button. I'm not okay with this. And she's like, well, why would we run into human remains? And I said, because it's a privy. And she's like, I don't understand. And I said, well, that's where people throw trash. And back in the day, they would throw everything in the privy.
Right,
and, you know, sometimes there were unwanted things that went into said privy. And she was just like, blew her mind. And I said, and I can't be a part of a show that could potentially be having human remains, and especially human fetal remains, just up on television for everyone to see. I'm not okay with that.
And what's kind of tragic is that here she is doing this show, and she's done no research. None.
Right.
Because she would have known this.
I don't think she was the producer. I think she was just the person who was out contacting people.
Right.
But, like, it just completely blew her mind that these things could possibly even be in a privy, and then that I wouldn't want to be part of it. And she tried to, like, she was very nice, and I'm not trying to say that she wasn't, but she kept trying to find all these different ways to, you know, couch it so that I would say, okay, I'll be on your show. And I was just like, no, I can't do that. I said, and the other thing I told her, I said, you do realize that a show like this, if I were on it and it was done poorly, this would be career suicide for me.
Absolutely.
And she's like, no, I don't think it would be at all. I mean, you'd be on television and everyone would know you were an authority. And I said, I'm not a doctor. I don't have my PhD, so I'm really not qualified to be talking about things at this level.
Right.
So first off, I would be being arrogant. And secondly, I cannot be associated with looters. I can't. I said, I'm sure they're very nice men, but they are still looting.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the deal, Sarah, that actually your experience is very common. And I've talked to a number of other people who, when we bring up these moral and ethical dilemmas, this is why we cannot participate in this. This is why we think what you're doing is wrong. It's not even that people have tried to argue the point. It's they don't even get the point in the first place.
Yeah, they don't even
understand the problem?
Why it's wrong. Yeah.
Right. So it's like we're completely talking at cross purposes here. But this is entertaining. People will want to see it. I go, well, people might actually turn on to a show if you did public executions. That doesn't mean public executions are legitimate just because, and we come back to what we started with, just because you probably could sell a lot of laundry detergent on that show doesn't make
doesn't
it right. And you know, it's those are folks who, and on an optimistic note, maybe those are people who can be educated concerning why these are issues, why we don't want to see the past destroyed for entertainment purposes, why we would love it if they would focus on real deal archaeology so people can understand what the human past of North America, what it really shows. And it's mind-boggling
and
cool.
I totally tried to sell her on that. Like I tried to explain it to her. I only had an hour on a Skype call, and I tried to explain the ethical and moral problems here, not to mention like the legal problems they were going to encounter.
Right.
I said, and you know, I would totally be okay if you wanted to bring in a team of archaeologists and we would excavate the privy, and they, your two gentlemen, could be part of that excavation. Not everyone on an excavation has to have a degree.
Sure.
I was like, and it would be great because then we would be including the public, and it would be done correctly. The paperwork would be filed, and anything that came out of there could be then used to further the archaeological record. And she's like, oh, yeah, I'll bring that up.
And I was like, oh. Good luck with that, right?
Yeah, I knew it was a shot in the dark, but I was like, I have to try. But yeah, it's never gone anywhere. They've never called me back, and I haven't seen it come up on the internet either. So I'm guessing it probably didn't get greenlit. But still,
right,
it's
right.
The fact that kind of thing even. I was waiting for the trap to get sprung the whole time, but she wasn't even trying to be devious. She just didn't really know.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's exactly why, you know, the experience I had with these guys who were more than willing to tell me that, okay, we'll say what you want. That's fine. We'll edit. It was all the end game here was to get something on TV that would draw a big audience.
Right.
And that how you got there, well, why is that even relevant? Why do you care? Don't worry about it. It's an amazing thing to talk to an academic, a researcher, an archaeologist, somebody who clearly is committed to exposing and illuminating the past, to say, well, don't worry about all that. You'll get to be on TV. I said, you know, I've been on TV.
It's not enough. That's
not that big a deal. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I want to point out, anybody who thinks, oh, well, you archaeologists, though, when you go on TV, they pay you a lot of money.
They don't pay you squat.
I tell you what. I did a thing for National Geographic. What I got for National Geographic, I got a T-shirt and a hat. That's usually – and that's a lot. I mean, they pay expenses. If they want to fly me someplace, that's fine. But nobody writes me any big checks because I'm on TV, and that's not what I'm looking for. If I can contribute to a documentary that's telling something interesting about the human past and you know, presents it in a legitimate way, I'm happy to participate. And I'm not looking to make a ton of money because it's not there.
Yeah, there's you don't do archaeology because you're going to get rich. You do archaeology because you're either obsessed with it or you're in love with it, one or the other.
Exactly so.
All right, so we're coming up on an hour. Is there any final thoughts that you want to share with us about television and pseudo-archaeology?
You know, I think the bottom line here, Sarah, is that television, TV, cable, provides an enormous potential. There's a great potential there for folks who are interested in, you know, the real past, the story as exposed by archaeology. And the deal is that real archaeology is infinitely more interesting, I think, than the kind of crap that's the standard fare about the human past, about archaeology today. And so there's great potential, but it's our job. It's jobs of archaeologists and people who support archaeology and are interested in it to educate the people making these TV shows that, you know, there should be room in between America Unearthed and the search for legendary giants and lost civilizations of North America and ancient aliens and the search for ancient aliens. There should be enough room in that huge field there for a show or two, which is, look at this. We have a city just a few miles outside of St. Louis, and it's 700 years old, and it's Native American. We have amazing artwork secreted in deep in canyons in Utah and in New Mexico and Arizona. And we have a huge effigy of a snake in southern Ohio. That stuff is so interesting. We should have shows about that. And, you know, interview real archaeologists, and, you know, and there are plenty of mysteries out there, really interesting things that real archaeologists are attempting to solve. And, you know, if we can get a couple of shows like that on TV, I think we'd be doing a lot better than we're doing now.
I still think we need to have a CRM archaeology reality television show where it's like Big Brother, and they just put everybody in the same house. And so they take us out in the field and work us for 10 hours. And then bring us home to the same house and watch us all just slowly destroy each other. And then you'll be like, there's – and Chris wants to host that show. So I would be on it.
You do know, Sarah, that the only problem with that would have to be on one of the like HBO or something, because the language would be inappropriate. You know that, right? The language would be totally inappropriate for children or sensitive people or practically for anybody except archaeologists.
Yeah. We are known for our colorful language. I learned how to swear in Danish this last field season.
Well, there you go. There you go. That's excellent.
So I'm very excited about that. Well, Ken, thank you very much for another show. We will probably come back and revisit this topic over and over again as we go.
Because
there's so much to touch on.
It's great talking to you, Sarah, and look forward to the next one.
Yeah, sure. Talk to you later.
But we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs.
Thanks for listening. We hope you've enjoyed it and possibly learned something new or useful. If you like what you've heard, please head over to the iTunes or wherever you can and rate and review us. Share us wherever you socialize online and send us an email at archaefantasies@gmail.com with your questions, comment, or just angry emails. You can follow the podcast at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaefantasies. You can follow us on iTunes, and you can follow the blog at www.archaefantasies.com. And get updates at ArchieFantasies on Twitter and Tumblr. Also, you can look for us on Facebook. If you're looking for the show notes with links to things we've discussed in this episode, check out the podcast website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/ArchieFantasies. And thanks again for listening.
No, we don't do dinosaurs. No, we don't do dinosaurs. Raise your trials as one will call. No, we don't do dinosaurs.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.